Hello and welcome to The Late Debate with me, Audrey Carvel. Coming up, your right to privacy and your right to be forgotten.
The decision by the European Court of Justice has, I think, for the first time, put the legal responsibility for access to that content onto search engines.
Are there any secrets left in Ireland? Data protection, data retention and freedom of information. It's our late debate tonight after the news from Clodagh Walsh.
Good evening from the newsroom. The Taoiseach has urged the former Minister for Justice, Alan Shatter, to waive his entitlement to a ministerial severance payment of €70,000. Asked about Enda Kenny's position on the issue, a government spokesman said it has been the policy to end severance payments to former ministers and that everyone should adhere to that, including Alan. It's not clear whether Mr. Shatter intends to accept the payment or waive his entitlement. He could not be reached for comment. However, sources said the Taoiseach did not have the power to direct Mr. Shatter to waive the payment. The Insolvency Service of Ireland has said that 100 people have been made bankrupt under the new three-year bankruptcy regime. Another 100 borrowers have secured insolvency deals, and there has been a doubling in the number of people securing debt agreements every month. The chief executive of the Insolvency Service, Lorcan O'Connor, said that after a slow start, the process was gathering pace.
We saw the 100th bankruptcy case yesterday in the High Court, and earlier this month we also saw the 100th case for the new solutions introduced through the Personal Insolvency Act. So they are two important milestones, and we have seen a doubling of cases in recent months. So we would expect that trend to continue through the rest of the year.
Nigeria's National Emergency Management Agency says at least 118 people have been killed in twin car bombings in the central city of Jos. Police had put the death toll at 46. The explosions occurred within a short time of each other in a busy market and outside a nearby hospital. No group has said it carried out the attack. The Nigerian president, Goodluck Jonathan, condemned the blasts, calling the perpetrators cruel and evil. A post-mortem examination is due to be carried out on the body of a woman discovered in a camper van in County Clare. The woman, in her 60s, was found when Gardaí were called to a campsite in Corrafin this afternoon. It's understood she had travelled to the area from England last week. The alarm was raised after the woman had not been seen since the weekend. The weather forecast, heavy showers in the west tonight, but it will become mainly dry elsewhere. Lowest temperatures 7 to 10 degrees. Showers tomorrow, mainly in the west, drier elsewhere with sunny spells. That's it from the newsroom for the moment. We'll have news again at 11, but for now, back to you, Audrey.
Clodagh, thank you very much indeed. You're very welcome back to The Late Debate. And tonight we're debating the right to privacy versus the right to information, if that information should be retained and how it is protected. It's topical and it's controversial following last week's ruling by the European Court of Justice that search engine companies like Google must remove on request certain types of information that may be deemed out of date or no longer relevant. The implications of the ruling so far from clear, but privacy rights campaigners are declaring it a major victory. Opponents say it's censorship. So just how much information about each other should we have access to? Is the state one of the biggest culprits when it comes to breaching people's privacy? And is there still resistance when a citizen wants information from the state? With me in studio tonight are Billy Hawkes, Ireland's Data Protection Commissioner, Solicitor Simon McGarr, who represented Digital Rights Ireland in a data retention case taken to the European Court of Justice this year. And also here is Fine Gael TD Regina Doherty, who was a member of the Oireachtas Committee, which decided on the Freedom of Information legislation last November. From London tonight, we're joined by Wendy Grossman, security journalist and member of the advisory councils of the Open Rights Group and Privacy International. You're all very welcome indeed to our programme. Simon McGarr, first of all, this ECJ ruling in relation to search engine companies, is it censorship?
No. That's definitely an easy one to answer, and probably going to be one of the easiest questions that we'll manage to be given during the course of the day. No, it's not censorship. The information which has been published by the original publishers remains where it is. It hasn't been taken down. People can still go and find it. What this involves is an alteration in the balance of power between companies whose job it is to aggregate data on individuals and individuals whose data has been aggregated. So it's definitely a balancing towards the rights of the individual over the rights of commercial entities or even non-commercial entities, but large organisations to aggregate data and use it for new and unforeseen uses.
So just to simplify, if Wikipedia, just use them for example, if they put up information about me, I can go to their website, access it and read it. But if I was to type in a search into the Google search engine with my name, and the information that was on the Wikipedia site may not come up in that search.
That's right. You could request that it be removed. You wouldn't get it automatically removed just on a request. Only information which meets certain criteria is going to be removed. And that question of what those criteria are is the major question that has to be teased out now over the coming probably months and years to, from now on. Certainly the question of what is relevant is going to be one of the issues. What is proportionate in terms of people's access to your information, your history. And it will come down to, first of all, as the first line of defence, Google to make those decisions, or the other search engine companies, Google's being the largest. They'll have to decide, make those calls, first of all, is this a reasonable request by an individual under the circumstances? And an article about a public figure is much less likely to be taken down than an article about a private citizen. And so you have a sort of an algorithm, which, of course, Google is good at. Eventually, they will find a way of working this out. But you have to have an algorithm where you consider lots of different aspects of a query, who the person is, what is the information they've asked to take down, why was it there in the first place, how long has it been there, have the circumstances changed, or are they still relevant for public debate? What's its wider implications for society? These are extremely complicated questions for something like a private company to have to deal with. But that's their first line. They're going to have to answer a question. And then there'll be another line behind that, which is there has to be somewhere you can go if you don't agree with their decision. And that's where we are as a result of this court decision. Google disagreed with a request to take something down. And now the court has found that that was a reasonable request. Yeah. We have one data point.
And Billy Hawkes, you're the data protection commissioner in this country. As Simon was saying there, it sounds very complex. It sounds like it could get wrapped up in a legal framework very quickly. Will your office be involved in any of this process?
Well, yes, we get involved as an appeal body. If, for example, somebody asks Google or another search engine to take down a link to a particular website, a piece of information on a newspaper or whatever, and Google says no, that in the Balancing Act we don't think that that's justified, then the person can come to us on appeal and get us to do it.
And what would you do?
Well, we'd have to obviously make the same sort of Balancing Act. We're assuming, by the way, that Google chooses to do this Balancing Act because at least it's arguable that it would meet the terms of the judgment if it simply gave people a tool to take down the link without doing the Balancing Act. That's something which I think needs to be explored, and we'll see what Google's solution is. But certainly, as Simon says, they'll be looking for an algorithm, a technological solution, because obviously it will otherwise be impossible or very difficult to handle the volume of requests they're likely to have. So I certainly wouldn't be too surprised if they opted for, we will give you the tool which allows the individual to take down the link if they want to, which would then means they wouldn't have to do this Balancing Act. Whether or not that meets the terms of the judgment, it would be an interesting question.
Wendy Grossman in London. Wendy, what's your assessment of the significance of the ECJ ruling?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, and it's a very complicated ruling, and I don't think, as Simon's already said, I don't think we're going to really see how it plays out for a number of years. I do think that it has started a really important conversation that we kind of should have had sooner, which is about how powerful we want things like Google to be in terms of controlling access to information and being the place that people go to look up everybody. I mean, there is this concept in Europe of being able to recover from mistakes, and I think one of the concepts I run across in the UK that are not familiar to me from my US background is the concept of a spent conviction, where, you know, you've done a punishment, you have been rehabilitated, and now the original crime is forgotten. And there is no way of doing, you know, search engines are not designed currently to be respecters of that. And it's not an American thing. I can understand why they're not, because most of them are American.
Regina, what's your view on this? Because reading a BBC article today, it learned that more than half of the requests sent to Google from the UK in relation to this ruling involved convicted criminals. It was a man who tried to kill members of his own family, wanted the article taken down, a celebrity's child who wanted links to news articles about a criminal conviction removed, a convicted cyber stalker, a man convicted of running a tax scam.
Yeah, it's intriguing. I mean, the judgment is completely intriguing, and where it's going to lead to over the next couple of years is going to be really interesting to either watch and or to be part of. I think the first thing it does for me is that it looks at and very much challenges the commercial aspects of people like Google and search engines, which are the purveyors of all information of, you know, on anybody and everything. And now obviously that has been challenged and that is no longer going to be the norm. But what's intriguing is that those standards that the search engines will base or the test that they will base, you know, whether the information is outdated, whether it is irrelevant. Who is actually going to determine that? Is it the individual corporations themselves? Are we going to set those standards in law across Europe, internationally, in individual countries? And I do think what's very worthwhile about the judgment last week is that it will now give rise to that conversation that maybe we should have had years ago as the World Wide Web was developing and search engines were developing. But now is we're primed to have it now. And yet it is immeasurably complex, right down to the point, and I was reading articles in the Irish Times in the last number of days, to the people who are in the position to actually have the judgment call at either European court level or even individual countries' jurisdictions of their courts, whether those people are actually technologically advanced enough to be fully aware of the ramifications that technology now poses to people's privacy. And it is going to be intriguing.
Simon, you wanted in there.
Just on the last point, whatever about any local jurisdictions across Europe, I definitely think that the ECJ knew exactly what they were doing when they were making this decision. This is in direct line with its previous decision in relation to the Digital Rights Ireland case, which was only a month earlier. This is a new form of judgment by the European Court of Justice. It is a human rights format that it sits in. It sits with a full panel of judges. It produces long and well-reasoned judgments. Not that the other judgments aren't well-reasoned, but they're usually quite snappy. These ones are discursive. And I think that they are building up a body of case law in respect of the privacy, respect for the individual, and in respect of the rights of the individual in a world where data brokers, whether they be commercial or any other form of data broker, a state entity, can have so much information about a human being that the court sees itself as one of the bastions in world affairs for the rights of the individual and the rights of the individual to their privacy.
And the case you're talking about there, Digital Rights Ireland, that's to do with telecoms companies retaining information.
It is, and they were retaining information because states wanted to have access to that information for the purposes of investigating crimes, also in relation to national security questions and so on. But in order to prepare for a thing that hadn't happened, a future investigation, they didn't even know whether it would happen, but they felt it might, they were engaged in the mass surveillance of the location, not merely the phone calls, but the location, the physical location of the entire population of Europe, in effect, because everyone with a mobile phone was being tracked and their movements were being recorded. And so the court found that that was disproportionate and contrary to the Charter of Fundamental Rights. And I think that this is a kind of a judgment that as the Charter takes hold across Europe and in European case law, we're going to see an awful lot more of these major statements of principle from the ECJ, which has traditionally been a very powerful court, but has been a court which previously didn't concern itself with human rights primarily. It was economic and it would deal with matters of trade and so on. The European Union is about to accede to the jurisdiction of the European Court of Human Rights. And when that happens, the EU and the ECHR, two separate bodies, will now have to align themselves very tightly in a way which they said that they would in the past, but will now become very real in terms of binding case law, each on the other. There's a very long body of human rights case law from the ECHR, and I think it's clear that the European Court of Justice, which is an extremely powerful court with directly binding decisions, unlike the European Court of Human Rights, which has persuasive decisions but can't immediately strike down laws, that the European Court of Justice is intending to step up to the plate and make sure that they too speak for human rights when they're making these decisions.
And Wendy, does that mean that Europe is on a collision course with the United States? Because the United States, it appears at least at this point, is going in the opposite direction.
It certainly seems like it. And that's something that has been talked about ever since the original Data Protection Directive was passed. I remember Simon Davies, who runs Privacy International, saying back in 1995 that there could actually be a trade war over data protection. It seems entirely possible. It's interesting to me that all the Americans I know, well, almost all, not all, a few who are really really strong privacy advocates are actually seeing this current decision as a privacy issue. But there's quite a few Americans who are just seeing it as censorship and the blockage of freedom of expression. And I find that kind of hard to believe, because there have always been some limits on freedom of expression. And I see Google as more of a megaphone than a publisher.
And you make the point that we shouldn't be relying exclusively on Google for all the research that is done.
Yeah, when I started to think about the decision last week, I got sort of disturbed by the thought that people are so reliant on a handful of commercial companies to be the mediator, the gateways to all of their culture's information. I mean, it's kind of odd when you think about it that we have accepted so completely that Google should be the gateway to like all of British and Irish history. It doesn't really make any sense. And it's not like they're a library or something where we have made a cultural decision about how it's going to operate.
Billy Hawkes, in relation to the Google ruling, Simon said it's not censorship, but I think most people would agree it's a curb on freedom of information. Is that a good thing in your view?
I'm not sure I'd agree it's actually a curb on freedom of information, because I think, as Simon made clear, it does not involve in any way censoring the original source of the information. So the information, whether it's on a newspaper site, whether it's on some other type of site, it remains where it is. And furthermore, it remains where it is unless someone takes an actual movement to actually remove a link which links to themselves. It's only about personal data, not about issues as such, and we'll see how that works out in practice. But I think, as Simon says, what it does demonstrate is an effort by the European Court of Justice to basically give teeth to what is now a treaty obligation, because the European Union's own Charter of Fundamental Rights now has a specific article which says we all enjoy the right to data protection, even separate to the right to privacy. So essentially, I think what they were doing was doing a rebalancing of the rights involved here in the digital rights case. It was a particularly important rebalancing because I think many would say that in the light of 9/11 and so on, things had simply gone too far. We must all recognise that the state, because bad people operate on the internet and using telecommunications, you have to give the state some right to also get access to that information. The problem was there was massive access to all of our information. And as Simon says, if you think about the amount of information available to all of us from our mobile phones, it says exactly where we are at any particular time. And if you were to justify at some stage, I mean, where were you 6 months ago? Because your mobile phone says you were there, you had some difficulty doing so. So I think it is an important rebalancing. We must always recognise also there is the other side, if you like, to the argument. Nobody's arguing the state must act on behalf of all of us, for example, to protect us from serious crime and terrorism. And there should be some form of targeted right of access to telecommunications data, but not mass access. And I think in relation to the Google judgment, it, again, it's a rebalancing. All it does really is stop the megaphone effect that you're talking about, that you still have the data still available as it always was. It's just that it's not automatically available, producing an automatic profile of you, which may actually be quite inaccurate as well.
And Simon, you make the point, you know, something that would have been absurd to think about maybe 10 or 15 years ago is this question, do we have a right to know everything that's published about someone else?
I mean, because it wasn't possible, it never came up as an issue.
Do we have that right?
Do we have a right to know everything all at once? No, I don't think I have a right to know everything all at once. After all, do I have a right to read inaccurate information about a person? I don't think I have a right to have that delivered to me on a plate. And no one's ever asserted that there is such a right. And Wendy said that there were concerns in the US have been around freedom of expression. But of course, what that really is it's a concern that you're not able to aggregate expression. It's an indexing rather than publication, and an index is an extremely unsophisticated method of displaying information. So if I collect up everything that was ever said about you, good or ill, and if we could hear everything that ever was said and write it down and collect it all up, well. No, I don't have a right to hear all the things that were ever said about me in a pub. I don't have a right to ever hear all the things that were said about me on the corner as I pass. After all, those are private conversations that belong to those people. And they may be about me, but they were in a private zone. They were talking to each other and so on. So the right was never there. No one ever asserted it because it wasn't possible to have. The idea that we're now reaching a point where there's an index so comprehensive that we're reaching an issue where we think, is it possible and therefore do I have a right to do it? The very fact that it's possible means we ought to stop and ask the question, is this even something we may allow to do? Not that there's a right, but will we permit it? And I think what the court has said is, generally, we will not permit it under certain circumstances.
Mm. And Regina, it's very unclear at this stage how those cases will be decided. Sean in Cork has texted, is there no one of the opinion that we have a right to know if someone who has access to our money has been convicted for embezzlement, regardless of how long ago it was? Because for many, or for most of us, Google is the only way to access that sort of information.
Yeah, it's true. And I think that's the conversation that needs to be had now. And OK, obviously the ruling is starting that conversation as to whether we do have a right or not to have access to the information. But whether we do or don't, the practice has been established that people have access to that information. And it is the commercial basis of the likes of Google and Yahoo and other search engines that they have built the premise of their identity on providing us with this flurry of information. I mean, I have a generation of people growing up in my household that, you know, a question comes up that nobody knows the answer to. Well, will we Google it? Or I have a 7-year-old who goes around and tells me Google is your friend. You know, like, this is the generation that's coming up that don't know anything else. They didn't do what we did when we were in school, which was go to the library and research and compile our own data to do things. They just use Google as a tool because it's there and it does exactly what it says in the tin. It gives you copious amounts of information on the particular person, topic, you know, subject that you're looking for. And that has been established. Now, the curbing of that, obviously, over the course of the coming weeks, months, years, is going to be really interesting. And in particular, the reaction of the likes of Google and Yahoo and Bing is going to be equally interesting. Billy.
And could I also just, you mentioned there the examples that were being given of takedown requests to Google of people who were convicted of crimes. But to be fair, the punishment that was meted out by the court is you're sentenced to so-and-so for doing something, and that was made public in court. It wasn't part of the punishment, or wasn't supposed to be, that would be available for eternity to anybody. And particularly there was reference there to spent convictions legislation, which we have recently introduced in Ireland. And basically it says that, you know, after a certain amount of time, a conviction should be removed from your record if it's not particularly serious. Basically, once Google exists, that could never happen because there'd always be a link back to the original thing. So I think it's a question of restoring a balance that was always there. It's not a question of giving an easy time to people who have committed crimes, but basically there is a prescribed punishment for the crime. It doesn't include having it follow you for the rest of your
and
life.
And as you said, it will perhaps go to your office on appeal. Do you envisage your office making a judgment on whether the person should proceed with their case on appeal?
Well, no, well, first of all, an awful lot depends on what the reaction of the search engines are going to be. How are they going to handle this particular judgment? Because I could imagine, shall we say, an easy option could be to say, look, we'll just give everybody a tool to remove the links, mm-hmm. And they won't make any balancing judgment, in which case there'll be nothing to appeal. If they, as a matter of principle, or because that's their interpretation of the judgment, feel they must do this balancing act. If, for example, it's a prominent person is involved, and there's perceived to be a public interest in maintaining the link, and they judge, yes, we're going to maintain it. Well, then that person would have a right to appeal to us, and we'd have to go through the same, if you like, process, and then they would presumably have a right to appeal onwards to the courts. So it's not a prospect I would exactly welcome. We have enough work to do. So I would have a certain wish that they would interpret the ruling in a particular way that wouldn't involve a flood of appeals to
Simon,
our office.
You wanted in.
I think it's important to notice that this isn't the first time that Google had to deal with the potential of masses of people. And by masses, I mean tens of thousands of requests to remove links. Because Google already deals with tens of thousands of requests to remove links on the basis of copyright. And they have a system to deal with that. You have a form you fill in, you send it into Google, you notify them, you show them why it should go, and the link is removed. And they do that without any difficulty on copyright basis. Now, of course,
they do have that, but you really hope that they'll do a better job on this, because one of the problems with the copyright thing is that it's automated and it's a robot and it removes things without, basically, the default is remove it now and consider it later if someone complains. And you would actually like there to be sort of a bit more thought when they remove things.
Well, my suspicion is that that's going to be the opening. We've already got a machine for doing this. Let's just add an extra form to the same machine. But what Billy says is true. I think the important things that the court has said in terms of relevance, and of course, if someone is being put in charge of money, which was one of the suggestions from the commentators, then a question of embezzlement remains relevant. So that would be an answer to that if the courts... sort of menu of things to consider were going to be applied. But you are thinking about a room full of people or a building full of people who will be sitting there tapping their teeth, making judgments of Solomon hundreds of times a day if this is going to be scaled on a global level. So the difficulty is, I agree with Wendy, you'd prefer if it wasn't just a big lever that automatically got pulled and things got vanished. But on the other hand, that's quite a training exercise to train everybody up on what they will and won't do in terms of exercising judgment, that you can imagine a skyscraper full of people with those skills.
And Billy, Adrian Weckler, tech editor with the Irish Independent, is listening. He makes the point on Twitter that it'll be mainly rich and powerful who will avail of this opportunity, as he puts it, to scrub the web of their negative mentions. Do you agree?
Well, perhaps the rich and powerful, but not just only, I think, the rich and powerful. I suspect many of us, when we Google, if you do what's called a vanity search on yourself, things come up you might prefer were not there. Even if I've certainly done, there's at least one thing there which I would prefer were not there. I won't go into what it is. So I don't think
I'm Googling you now.
I have some photographs I'd like removed from a particularly unflattering jacket I found myself wearing in a public occasion, and I didn't know it was unflattering till forevermore I see myself in it.
Go ahead, Wendy.
I don't really understand why the rich and powerful would have an easier time getting something removed than anybody else, though, because it's not like this costs any money, right? You can complain about something being present on Google. Anybody can make that complaint. So it's a little hard for me to understand how the rich and powerful have an advantage. And the other point I'd make, of course, is that Google is the rich and powerful itself.
And the rich and powerful are more likely to be socially prominent than the rest of us, and therefore will find it more difficult to remove right, information
because
about them.
Because reporting on them is more likely to be a matter of public interest. That's why Private Eye is still in business. Mm.
Billy, going back to what you were saying earlier on about how the the state intervened and was breaching people's right to privacy after 9/11 and so on, and it got out of control. How would you assess it today in 2014 in relation to this state? How big a culprit is this state in breaching people's data?
Well, first of all, the state does it in accordance with the law, so it's not a question they're breaching the law. It's a problem that it's relatively easy, obviously, for the state to pass laws which says that we override a right you would otherwise have. So, for example, there's been an exponential growth in the amount of information the state holds on us. I mean, if you think through the amount of information held by different arms of the state, you know, the Department of Social Protection has information on all of us, so has the Revenue Commissioners. The Gardaí has information on most of us, because actually when it's not just people who commit crimes, if you report a crime, you're on the central pulse system. So, I mean, I just did a straw poll at home. Most of my family, I think all of us, are on the pulse system because we've reported minor crimes at various times. There have been victims of them. So, and then because the state, for good reasons of efficiency and customer service, has expanded the sharing of information, which again exponentially increases the danger that people will wrongly access the information, that in the worst case scenario they'll actually perhaps use it and sell the information to people. And that's not a major issue, but again, unfortunately, it has happened. So I think there has been an insufficient attention by the state to the huge leap that's happened in the last 20 years, from where basically information about us was on a physical file in a filing cabinet somewhere with very limited access to it, to where it's now on an IT system with access throughout an organisation, not only throughout an organisation, but through data sharing also available to other people. And we're a small country, so the chances someone in the public service will know somebody else is quite large. And we should have an expectation when we give information to any public body that it will only be used for the purpose for which it is given. The audits we've carried out of some of these bodies have shown a very mixed picture in terms of the degree of attention being paid to that duty. And the state should be held to a higher standard, I think, than the private sector, because we have no choice but to give this information to the state. So I'm not happy as I leave this job that the state is doing a good enough job. I would like to see a much better effort done by the state to protect us, to basically fulfil the obligation they have towards all of us, that fair enough, for good public policy reasons, they need a certain amount of information on us to deliver services and so on. But the quid pro quo is that they have a very strong duty towards us to mine that information. And I would also hope that the state would be, if you like, less willing to invade or to pass laws which interfere with privacy, such as data retention. Because in fact, in Ireland, we had data retention laws before it became a European obligation. And my predecessor, Joe Mead, did his best efforts to stop the state from going this direction. But he was trumped by legislation. So I think I'm glad things have come around. So basically, the state now is being told from Europe, you have gone too far and you're going to have to limit the degree of access that you give to law enforcement in relation to telecommunications.
And in relation to, you're talking about your family, and you're saying most of us are probably on the pulse system or whatever. How long is that data retained for?
Again, at present, the Gardaí have a policy of retaining data indefinitely. So it's one of the things we highlighted in our audit, that they need to develop a clear policy on retaining data. So they have undertaken to do so. Because again, the longer you hold the information, the more potential that it will be misused in some way. So I think it's a very important point. And again, it's something which comes out also of the Google judgment, the importance of having a clearly thought out retention policy for data. So it's something that, again, that we insist on whenever we carry out audits, whether it's in the public sector or the private sector.
Regina, what do you say to that?
Obviously, I would concur with what Billy is saying, and to go one step further. And again, it's probably prompted now for us to have another conversation, or just to open up the conversation again with regard to our own Data Protection Act, which is probably, it's 10, 11 years old now since it was last amended. There should be standardisations of the policies, not just necessarily across, obviously, state bodies, but all organisations that keep data. There should be standardised privacy policies. There should be standardised retention terms. There should be data protection officers in every organisation that holds information. And that should be enshrined probably in legislation or guidelines and recommendations from government. And I think it's probably prompt now that we have that conversation again. Like, we've just are in the final throes of finalising the Freedom of Information Act. Maybe once that's finished, then the next thing we should do is to start modernising our data protection acts. And not just because of what's happened with the ECJ, but with the huge advancements of technology in the last 10 years. So we have to take account of the modernisation of the tools that we're using, not just in business, but in everyday social scenes, in the likes of Facebook, Twitter. I mean, even I was reading today with regard to the judgment, although it affects search engines, it doesn't affect the likes of Facebook, YouTube, Twitter. So you may get something taken down, but it still may live in the halls of Facebook or Twitter or any of the other kind of social media aspects. And where that's really relevant, not just to famous people who might want to hide something, the jacket that they wore in 2003 or the shoulder pads that they have. There's a real growth of people not being able to do anything at the moment that they're videotaped and it's put up on social media. And particularly I'm talking about younger people who, and we were all young and we were all mad and did silly things, but in my day there was never anybody to catch you, to capture it for the halls of ages. And there are certain people's lives who are absolutely being ruined and devastated because that history will never ever leave them. And they need to be able to make mistakes, learn by them and move on. So
But in relation to the state's breaching of privacy, doesn't that just erode people's trust?
Of course, absolutely, of course. And I mean, look, we've had long conversations in the media and in every household in the country over the last couple of months with regard to the pull system and accessing it either authentically or not. That's only one arm of a strategy body that's holding information. There are hundreds, and each of them needs to have standardised policies that we can have trust in that are actually adhered to. But unless you give those standardisations from government as a norm, then obviously people are going to be sticking their finger in the air to say, well, how will we do it? So that needs to be clarified. And I think, as I said, once we finish the Freedom of Information Act, I think we should start again on the Data Protection Act.
Simon.
I think the Freedom of Information Act is actually relevant in this discussion, because when it comes to the coercive power of the state, which is unlike the power of Google or Facebook, which is more an attractive power, you know, you can get something out of it, but the state can simply tell you to do something and you must do so. Freedom of Information is the sunlight that can be shone in making sure that that information is being used correctly. And, I mean, you know, there's no question but that the state would like to bring in a Freedom of Information Act, provided it wasn't too uncomfortable for it. I think that there is still a resistance in a great deal of the civil service and the administrative class that nothing too radical happened as a result of the new act. I think that the insistence, the minister's insistence on keeping an upfront fee, whose main purpose when it was brought in, and certainly whose main impact when it was brought in, was to significantly reduce the number of requests under the FOI Act. I think that this is a way of managing the potentially radical change that a fully transparent government and administrative system would represent. I mean, problems grow in darkness. Problems grow where there's no oversight. And you can have oversight bodies. I mean, the Commissioner's Office is one of those bodies. But it's much more useful to have every single citizen as a potential pair of eyes who can ask on a whim for something that that has been done inside an administrative structure, when that's even a potential issue, when that might happen. Problems don't arise because every citizen at any time could ask for an explanation, could ask for the records, could ask to see, how did you get to that point? How did we reach that decision? We're not ready for that.
Actually, that's one of the things about Google that kind of does bother me, is that we can't ask Google how a particular search result was reached, because it's all in the algorithms, which are trade secrets.
We certainly can't find out why has Google put this particular photograph of me in a wetsuit up at the top of the post?
Didn't know it's a wetsuit, Simon.
Sometimes it's a wetsuit. I find that the algorithm decides how it feels about me on a day-to-day basis. I might like to know why that's happened, or why, you know, the weather changes, as they say in the world of search engine, the search engine business. Google is the climate, is the weather for these things. I do think that there's probably something that hasn't been explored yet, which is, from the point of view of the judgment immediately, obviously it's focused on Google, and then we can open it out and say, well, it's focused on search engines. But really, what do search engines do? They aggregate and index information. And that is not an activity which only search engines do. And really what I think we're going to see is we're going to see an increase in the commercial value of non-public indexes. The famous paywall debate in journalism. Databases which are paywalled, which are non-public, will have the capacity to show you information, index information, and produce it that a public database won't be able to, because people will be able to ask to have this, that, and the other taken out. And there are very serious reasons why, for commercial reasons, that is, why people would like to have access to a comprehensive database. I don't know whether we'll find a paywalled Google equivalent starting to appear. But if you look at things like Bloomberg, the Bloomberg terminals, that's basically a data aggregation system, an incredibly complicated data aggregation system, laser focused on the commercial possibilities of that data delivered as quickly as possible to the people who are willing to pay a great deal of money for that information. I think we're going to see that paywalled archives, paywalled searches become a part of the landscape in the way that they haven't been to date, because you could get everything for free mm-hmm. from Google. Would you pay?
Do you agree, Wendy?
I think he's raised a really interesting prospect, which is the notion of driving the kind of indexing Google is doing behind a paywall. I think that's a fascinating idea.
You can see why they keep putting the picture of the wetsuit up.
and of course, there already are sort of behind the scenes data brokers whose company names are unknown to most of us, who swap information.
Regina, I just want to come back to you on the points that Simon was making there about freedom of information and how it feeds into this whole issue. What do you say to that?
I think the argument around the time, and Simon alluded to it there, was that there is some struggle going on between the minister, Brendan Howland, and the officials with regard to the fee that's associated with the application by non-personal people looking for requests on personal information. And I somewhat disagree. Because number one, because I genuinely have huge respect for Brendan Howland. I think he has... he's a man of integrity, and it's because of him that the changes that were made to the Freedom of Information Act are being reversed, and only because of him. And also because of the 70% of the stuff that's actually accessed by people are personal and will remain free. And on the basis that during the oral hearings that we have on the legislation a number of months ago, that he did instruct that if money was no object, if we were awash with money at the moment, then there would be no need to have the administrative fee for that, and that maybe at some stage in the future he might be able to look at that again. But given the multiplicity of some of the requests that are made at the moment, and I think in fairness one would have to agree when you look at some of the requests that are made, that they're not, you might get 10 questions in a particular request that 9 of them have nothing to do with the original request, it is fair to say that, you know, there has to be some sort of administrative cost associated with the compiling of the information. Now, obviously, we would all wish that it was free and in the transparency.
But that doesn't hold water on the basis of the information that the minister was able to give. Because as it turned out, the cost of collecting the fee is greater than the amount of money raised by the fee. So you're actually costing the state money by charging this fee. So to say that it's because we don't have the resources and we have to contribute towards it, we're actually costing ourselves money. The one thing that we do know that the fee does is it keeps down the non-personal requests. The reason that personal requests, which are free, are 70% of the current cohort of requests.
It's because other people are not willing to pay for the information.
Is that the fee has actually curtailed non-personal requests to a dramatic extent? I think it's 2/3 since the fee came in. There was an enormous drop. That's why the free applications are in the majority. We've actually managed to suppress the applications which were going in prior to the fee being brought in. So one, it's not reasonable to say, we're in straitened financial times. We're actually spending money in order to discourage requests. We're not saving money, we're spending it. And two, what we're doing there is in the discussion of, well, there are lots of requests and some of them aren't relevant, is that there's some sort of pre-filtering where an administrative body or the administrative class is deciding what the public should and shouldn't know or should and shouldn't ask.
No, well, I can't argue the first point with you because I'm not aware of what you've just said. And if it's true, I totally take it on face value. And obviously, we'd have to go back and have a look at the information that was supplied to us by the minister. But the second point, I disagree, because it isn't trying to pre-filter anything. You can ask anything that you want, so long as that if you're asking a question about apples, then ask it about apples. If you want to know about bananas and oranges, well, then ask separate questions. And OK, there's the 30 quid needs to be paid for the apples, the oranges and the bananas. There's nobody stopping you from having the information. But from my understanding was that there is a cost associated with providing the information. And in some days, and it's pretty much similar to in my job, the parliamentary questions that we ask, or if we do ask of other statutory bodies, there is scores of people sitting around doing nothing else except providing the information that should be freely available. I could totally agree with you, but there is a cost associated with that. And my understanding was that he was trying to recoup that cost so that we could continue to provide the service in the same manner as we've always done.
Well, I mean, the minister was able to say in the committee he didn't have any arguments or he didn't have any numbers or estimates which would disagree with the report done by Task, which set out that at best it was income neutral, that the cost that of collecting the fee spent all the money that was collected by the fee.
Okay. Billy Hawkes.
No, I think just a general point, and I think we should give credit to the impact of the Freedom of Information legislation in terms of encouraging the public service to make more things public. In other words, to think from the beginning, why does this have to be done, in secret to start with? So, and obviously the recent events which have led to tribunals and so on, which involves more information being made public. So I think that's a strong encouragement to the public service, actually, to think, first of all, why does this need to be kept, as it were, in-house? Why not put it up on the website? So I think that that is, in fact, one of the most positive benefits of FOI is to encourage that type of behaviour on the part of the public service rather than actually have to ask for the information.
One of the things that the minister said that he was in favour of, and I think it's going to be potentially it could be even more radical than a full FOI act, although it would be good to have both, is the idea that the service would move to preemptive publication, where they would simply say, this is something everyone should know, let's just put it out there. We don't wait to be asked. Mm. We won't have teeth pulled, we'll just publish it on our website. And I think the obvious first step, the obvious first example, is to have the databases of expenditure. They were obtained under FOI, therefore there is no principal reason why they shouldn't be published. Mm-hmm. The certain departments, the House of the Oireachtas, had theirs obtained under FOI after a very long and involved set of appeals and struggles and so on. But they were obtained, they were published. And once that principle is established, that that's reasonable, why not have everybody, every government body, publish its expenditure line by line up on the website? The amount of potential problems which would be erased by that kind of transparency after the inevitable storm on the first set of publications. But if it was on a boring quarterly or monthly basis, here's what we spent the money on this month, here's what we spent the money on this month, we wouldn't be the first country in the world to do it, though we would be amongst the first. But the principle's established, it may be done. Why is it not? And that would be something the government could do simply on a matter of policy. It's not legislation required. They could simply decree at the next cabinet meeting, let's start doing that. The most radical form of transparency you could imagine. What is the public's money being spent on?
Yeah, absolutely. Wendy, what's the position there in the UK? Does FOI work well or is there much resistance from the state to it?
It's not really my area of expertise. I did go to a meeting last year or maybe the year before where they were discussing reforming it a bit. I think there have always been discussions about You know, there's this kind of endemic fear that what will happen is that people will inundate some agency with questions, and so they have this whole thing about vexatious requests and stuff. And I think my impression is that it's working pretty well as it is, and the people who didn't like it to begin with would like it to be more restrictive, and the people who campaigned for it for a long time would like it to be taken further. You know, is kind of what you'd expect. But, you know, there's a big push in the UK for open data, which is kind of a related thing, which is, you know, like you guys were just talking about, making expenditures available. You know, the UK government is doing a lot of work to open up data sets so that anyone can take a look at them and reuse them in various ways.
And Wendy, I think that there's been a lot of movement in opening up things like geographical data and postcodes,
right,
and so on in the UK.
Right.
Here, we're only just thinking about having postcodes.
I know!
We haven't quite
only
got to the point
about
of opening them up yet.
But, I mean, I know, it's hilarious.
The proposal, there are certain postcodes that are very valuable in bits of Dublin, and whether they're going to survive the new system or not, I think that'll be interesting. But certainly the postcode system that we appear to be moving towards in whatever many years it is planned to deliver it, seems to be where the UK's postcode system closed and inaccessible and released only on payment of license fees and so on.
Oh, I know. It was the most astonishing thing to me. Back in the early 90s, I was assigned to write a piece about copyright and the phone book and the postcode address finder database. And I was just staggered to find out that these things were copyrighted and considered these terribly secret things that you had to pay for. I mean, you know, in the U.S., there's actually a legal judgment on the books. You cannot copyright the phone book, because the view is that you didn't do any work beyond alphabetizing things, and that's not enough to justify copyrighting.
I'm just going to read some texts from our listeners. Ed says, "Pedophiles up and down the land will rejoice at the Google ruling. It's a bad day for child protection." Alonza says, "Only a fool would put anything they care about on an electronic line. This is an excellent debate. I'm snowed under with books as I text you. I've no need for Google for research, and I pity today's kids. A little knowledge is a dangerous thing." Barney says, "The rich and powerful have more time, money, connections and access to expertise than the poor and the underprivileged, who find themselves under pressure." And this is from Joe for you, Billy, on data protection. Years ago, he says, the Irish Army officer element looked quietly for the right to get anyone in the state's phone files, and they got that permission. Anyone from the rank of colonel up can access anyone's phone files. Power and legal and illegal use and abuse of information is big business. Private security is big. Is that true?
No, I think that our data retention regime does allow three arms of the state. That's the Gardaí, the Army and the Revenue Commissioners to access telecommunications data. So he's correct in that. Just one point there that just to bear in mind about the need when the state is planning something new to think through the privacy implications, because postcodes were mentioned. We apparently are opting towards a house-based postcode. So just bear in mind that can have very negative implications for people. It allows for negative profiling of people and areas based on a postcode. You can't do that at present with the limited postcodes we have in Dublin. I mean, basically, any particular postcode will have a mix of different types of people, different income levels and so on. Mm-hmm. With the proposal that we have a house-based postcode, there's huge potential there for abuse, which has not been thought through.
Yeah, you know, in the UK, they talk quite a bit about how identifiable certain kinds of data sets are, simply because the postcode has a varying number of houses in it, but some of the number is really small. If you're talking about a house-based postcode, where each house has a different one, you're going to be any database that has people's addresses in it, or has their postcodes in it, is going to be basically an identifiable data set. Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, this is one of those moments where a bit of forethought, which Billy is referring to as required, will recognise that the postcode plan as currently being proposed, and we're a couple of years off it yet, but there seems to be a lot of money riding on this plan going ahead. But the postcode plan, as it's being set at the moment, for anybody who has any kind of realization as to where these things, how these things link together and where you're going with them, it does look like something that it probably is the next electronic voting machine in terms of a terrible crash between a technologically sort of unsophisticated commissioning side from the administration and a commercial side happy to sell them a product off the shelf or a happy to run up bills on a commercial basis, and the person in the middle being the citizen being lost in between that very unequal struggle between the commissioning tendering side and the commercial sort of technical expertise side. I do think that the postcode proposal as it stands will get worse before it gets better. It does appear that the government has committed themselves to doing things which a subsequent government will have to reverse or scrap. It's going to be very expensive if they spend all the money first. And it appears that at least some of the contracts are already signed and are already in place. So we're committed to doing certain things which I think we will regret having done in only a year, 2 years, 3 years down the road.
Regina.
Yeah, I can't speak to that either because I'm not fully aware of what it is that's been awarded or what's on route. But then maybe it is good, even though Ireland are usually behind the curve in these things, that we are still only considering and thinking about what kind of system that we're going to have. To go back to one of your texters, to give solace to them, the Google judgment doesn't automatically mean that people who are paedophiles or sexual predators who are actually on the register will get off scot-free and will go into an abyss, because something very similar to what is known internationally as either Sarah's Law or Megan's Law has been currently considered by the Department of Justice and will be law probably within the next 6 to 12 months. And that will give rise to people who have and are on the register and have a history of being a predator from a sexual perspective, either to an adult or to a child, will be listed, and that information will be freely available as to where they are in the jurisdiction. So that should give comfort.
Billy, just to finish up, we're in the last 4 minutes or so of the programme. In relation to breaches of data protection by the state, does your body, the Data Protection Commission, have enough powers to punish those people, or are you lacking in teeth?
The general ethos of our legislation is corrective. In other words, we're given very strong powers to bring about change, to require change, not against the state, because the state can trump, if you like, anything with using separate laws. But what is coming down the track from the European Union is very strong legislation, a directly applicable regulation, which includes fines directly applied by the Data Protection Authority of up to €1 million. So that type of fining power is coming down the track. But I wouldn't put too much emphasis on the power of fining. I think the reputational damage to an organisation that fails to protect the data of its consumers, the power to force an organisation to, for example, stop processing, as we did last year in one organisation, that's far more effective, I think, as enforcement than just slapping a fine, which for a big company won't matter anyway.
Do you agree, Regina?
Yeah, like there's the easy reaction is that no, you should have more teeth and you should be able to come down on top of people like a ton of bricks. But this, the soft corrective measures that are there are actually very, very powerful. And not just to organisations' reputations, but also obviously to individuals' reputations. And so I think they do an extremely effective job given the legislation as it's currently constructed.
Simon, is reputational damage as effective as monetary punishment?
I'd like teeth as well as gums. I'd like it to be available that there could be the threat of worse happening if you don't improve. And that has to include fines. That's the case in breach of commercial activity across Europe. I mean, when the European Commission fines against you in a question of whether or not you've been involved in the cartel, there is reputational damage, but they'll also take hundreds of millions out of your bank account. And that's a real stick. I think what is at issue is not, first of all, whether or not the commissioner has enough power. I am not convinced, though, of course, I'm not entirely at one with the commissioner on this. I'm not convinced that the level of funding, which is somewhere just under 2 million on the commissioner's budget, is sufficient to the requirements of regulating what is one of the largest industries in the entire world, which we have almost without noticing it too much ended up based on our in our jurisdiction. I mean, I use the example of the insurance industry in London. The UK is the world centre for insurance. Contracts are written with its jurisdiction. They spend $640 million a year regulating alone the insurance industry. I'm not suggesting that we should fine $640 million, though, you know, we might go down the road of one day placing a levy on the bodies that are here in order to pay for their own regulation. That's happened in other industries as well. But I think really that we have to recognise that we are in charge of, by accident and luck, or and partly by design, the data of millions of people all around the world. And what was acceptable for regulating data when they were paper files, which is what the data protection laws originally envisaged when they were paper files in filing cabinets, I think we need a much higher level of investment in making sure that we can continue to regulate effectively.
Very briefly, Billy.
Yes, I agree. And to be fair, the government has committed to giving us the resources we need in this area.
OK, thank you all very much indeed. We'll finish with a text from Derek in Wexford. There's only one thing worse than being found on Google, and that's not being found on Google. Derek, thank you very much indeed. Thanks to Wendy, to Regina, to Simon and to Billy. We're back at 10 tomorrow night. Till then, from all of us, good night.
The Late Debate, presented by Audrey Carvel, was produced by Peter Hegarty. The broadcast coordinator was Maeve Mooney. The researcher, Barry Lenehan. And sound supervision tonight was by Ciarán Dunne.